Hey everybody, it's Alex from Remote Work Life here, and I'm here again with Elaine Pofelt, who has been on the podcast before, and I'm so glad she has come back. Elaine is one of my favourite interviewees of all time on the podcast, and somebody I've spoken to a lot and learnt a lot from, not just because she is herself a freelancer. I mean, I've freelanced myself, I've been self-employed myself, so I've learned a lot from that respect. But Elaine is also a future of work. What I say is a future of work expert. She works remotely herself. She's a mother, so she knows what it's all about in terms of balancing work and life. So, as I said, learned so much. But apart from that, she has authored an inspiring book, a book that I've read myself, called The Million Dollar One Person Business. As well as that, believe it or not, she's also contributed and authored articles in the likes of The Economist, Fortune, Money, CNBC, Cranes, New York Business, Forbes, and many others. So, as you can probably imagine, she's a wealth of information, and you can probably understand why I've invited her back onto the podcast. Today, we want to talk about Elaine's latest book. And Elaine's latest book is something that I think if you not only are self-employed or a freelancer yourself, you'll get a lot from this podcast today. And I think apart from that, you should also buy the book yourself. And the book itself is called Tiny Business, Big Money. It's due to be released. When is it due to be released, Elaine?
It's on February 15th.
February 15th, so it's up and coming.
Yeah.
So, Elaine, welcome back to the podcast, and thank you for joining me again.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's great to be back. I remember our last conversation so well because my house was under construction, and I was literally sitting in a construction site. I don't know if you remember
that. I remember.
And I saw it online. I realized I was coated with construction dust.
Oh, wow. I didn't notice that.
Oh, I was like, I look so ghostly. And then I realized what it was. And I so enjoyed interviewing you for Forbes. I really loved that interview and the event we did with FreshBooks, and loved hearing your story as an independent worker and freelancer. And so it's so nice to reconnect with you because you live the life and you're experiencing everything that your audience is.
Oh, yeah. And I think it's nice, as I said, to come back together again, because you've obviously been doing a lot since we last spoke. And I'm just in awe of you from the respect of all the work that you do, all the great information that you put out, the books that you've written. And I'm just really excited to hear about your latest book today. How did that all come about, Elaine?
Well, I love writing about small business. Somehow I got hooked. I have no idea how. And so each project I do paves the way to the next one. When I did the $1 million one person business, the book went into paperback and we updated the book. So I had to go back to almost everybody in the book to find out what have they been up to lately. And one thing that emerged was a lot of them were not one person businesses anymore.
Right.
They had graduated to the next stage of building more of a formalized team. In the past, some of them did have contractors, but it would be like their bookkeeper, not a person that they would communicate with every single week necessarily. These have more of a team in a traditional sense, or they even have their first employees, up to 20 employees, but mostly up to 5 employees. And what they were saying to me was, you know, I like the solo thing. I needed to add people to grow. And now I'm kind of struggling a bit with this transition to where I have to manage people and tell them what I need them to do. And I started to hear that over and over again and realize there's a lot of value in finding out from people like themselves, how are they navigating this successfully? And so Tiny Business, Big Money looks at businesses with tiny teams, but that are still in that 7-figure range and generating profits to see what are their best practices. One of the things I found really interesting, because I interviewed almost 60 entrepreneurs for this book and also did an original survey with them, was they shared very common mindsets that I think are really relevant to anybody who's thinking about building a business that might start to grow to the point where they need a team. But even if you're still in the one person stage, one of them is that they're ready and willing to define their own future. And you and I have riffed on this a little bit in the past. I think there are a lot of people out there who will give us their best advice on what we should do with our careers. At a certain point, you have to take ownership of that decision. And these folks really have, even when other people around them might not have appreciated the value of it, and might have actually thought it was risky and dangerous. One woman I interviewed was Kathy Guggenauer, who runs a virtual assistant training program. She actually became a VA. And the reason she became one was she worked in telecommunications in the marketing area and wanted to get a promotion. And when she asked her boss, he said, well, if you get an MBA, I'll consider it. So she went out, did all the work of getting an MBA, thinking she's moving up the career ladder. When she came back to ask for the promotion, he said, well, you're not going to get that promotion because you laugh and smile too much. He didn't take her seriously.
Oh, wow.
She was so offended and pissed off that she decided to go out on her own. And first she did some type of direct sales program where she was selling candles, I think, but she didn't like that. And she decided to do something different. She started using her marketing skills to blog for real estate agents. And she got so good at it that she had more work than she could handle. And she started training other people to be a specialized virtual assistant who did the blogging for agents specifically. Then that became a little bit more general. And now she's grown it to a business with a team. And she's in her 60s. It's very inspiring because a lot of people over 50 find that it's hard to have a job because there's a subtle age discrimination. And she overcame that. She's got a great life. She lives in the woods. She does yoga and really enjoys her life. They also look at risk through a different lens than the average person. And one of the entrepreneurs whose story I also love, Anthony Coombs, is a serial entrepreneur. He's done kinds of things, sold mosaic tile online. He's created an app. He was selling autos online. And then a woman in his family told him that it was very hard to buy lingerie in plus sizes. And he saw an opportunity. He created a box company, like Birchbox, but it was with new sets of lingerie every month. And it really took off. And when we talked about risk, he told me a story about his mother being a public employee in Florida, and they had a change of governorship there, and she lost her job, and it put the family into terrible strife. And he, as a child, he had this conclusion that he would never work for anybody. He would always want to work for himself. And he said to me, what is a greater risk, to put my future in the hands of a company owned by someone else or myself? I'd say working for someone else is a much greater risk. Not everybody feels that way, but to succeed as an entrepreneur, I think it's important to recognize that you're not necessarily taking the riskier course for you if you own the fact that you've got to eat what you kill, so to speak, right? You know, you don't drum up the work, then it is risky. But if you are willing to work really hard and you put some financial protections in place, like building your savings, it might be less risky than having a job. Another thing is to keep showing up. One of the women that I spoke with, Abby Walker, she runs Vivian Liu, which makes shoe inserts to make high heels comfortable.
Right. And,
pardon me?
No, I was just saying, right. These.
Yeah, it's not really impossible, right, to make those things comfortable, but apparently they have. She didn't invent the insert. She found a group of MIT scientists. She actually loved high heels, and she used to work in an office, and she would blog about high heels, but she had kids like you and me, and she wanted to work from home so that she could be with them more. And she wanted to quit right away to work on it full time, but she couldn't afford to. She tried quitting for a few months, and she had an arrangement with her husband that if she didn't start making enough to make up for her income, she'd have to go back into the office. So she did do that, but she kept the business going on the side. And then she finally ended up being on a TV program as a result of a pitch night she went to. And then that caused the business to take off, and she could finally go all in with that business. Learn as you go along. A lot of us have gone through a career in corporate America where just making it up as you go along isn't okay. You've got to have a PowerPoint before you speak a word in a meeting, and maybe talk to the other people who will be in the meeting ahead of time to sort of troubleshoot in case the idea gets shot down. It requires so much strategy. You don't have the luxury of that kind of time in your own business. And you have to experiment. It's just part of the game. Elizabeth Davis at Shidavi, she's an Instagram influencer, but her real business is she makes products to help women grow their hair long, hair breakage. And she's an engineer by trade, but she invented the shampoos in her kitchen, tests them on her friends and family. And then the first day that she put them up for sale, I think she said she got 1,000 orders. And then she started growing the business more. Being willing to prepare the financial base you need is really important, right? People can run out of money. So maybe you have to work for the first 2 years in a job while you build the business so that you don't run out and you have a source of funds. And then it's really, just embracing it, going all in with it and understanding this isn't the choice that everybody else around you might be making, but it's the right one for you. Has ups and downsides, but it's definitely something worth pursuing for you, and that's what really matters.
And that idea of risk, Elaine, it's one of those things that, like you said, sometimes I think you get to the point, or one gets to the point where you feel as though you're in a job, it's stable, you've got your income coming in. Obviously right now there's no such thing, or I don't think there ever has been such thing as like a job forever, and there's no such thing as a permanent job anymore, because you know things are just so uncertain with everything. Isn't it? Like you said, you don't know how your boss might review you in terms of a promotion or whatever it may be. So it sounds like a lot of these people who you've interviewed have taken the bull by the horn, so to speak, to really put themselves in charge of their own future. But at the same time, they haven't just sort of dived into something by the sounds of it. They've actually really thought about businesses that really solve a problem. Like you mentioned, the high heel shoes, the virtual assistant. Was that really a trend in the people that you interviewed? You know, they're real problem solvers.
That's a really good point. I hadn't thought of it that way. I did talk a little bit about de-risking the business, and I think we're talking about almost the same thing. Putting it out to the marketplace of public opinion before you start spending a lot of money on it. One of the entrepreneurs is in Australia. Her name is Anna Gavia, and she was a medical student, and as sort of a pastime, when she wasn't studying medicine, she would sketch things, and she created bikinis, and she wanted to become a maker of bikinis. So she had a budget of about $200, and she found a plant that would make one bikini for her in size medium. She took a picture of it, put it up on Instagram, and saw if she got any pre-orders, and then 1,000 came in. So she went back to the factory. And that's a small run for many factories, so it was hard to find that factory, but they were willing to do it. And that was how she made her funds to keep going. And each time she introduced a new design, she would test it that way so that she didn't waste her limited startup capital. And I do think that's, in a way, making sure there's either a need or a want in the marketplace before you go further. Another entrepreneur, he's Canadian, he's from Toronto, Jason Vandergrant, is an engineering designer. He does CAD design, and he has an agency with people all over the world who do this designing for him. But he's a serial entrepreneur too. And he previously did an app for people who like to buy designer sunglasses, which is something that he likes to do. But he didn't do his homework enough on that one, and he spent about $29,000 on this app, and then found that there was competition that was making it impossible to turn a profit in this niche. So he closed it down, and he didn't want to waste his money anymore in the future. So now what he does is, if he has an idea, he creates a prototype of it, and he puts it up on a website that he gets from GoDaddy for just that month. And then he buys Facebook ads and drives traffic to the website and sees, similar to Anna, if people want to buy it. And if they don't, he practices non-attachment, if anybody does yoga or meditation, and just decides not to do it because he knows the market doesn't want it right now. Maybe they will in the future. So I think that's a best practice as well.
And you mentioned in the book things about the mindset. You mentioned also about how to find your ideal tiny business as well. You mentioned in the book as well, right? And is that typically, by the sounds of it, that's typically how some of the people that you've interviewed, I don't know, because I haven't read the book completely yet, but is that how they test their ideas in general, is by seeing what the market, or putting the idea out there into the world, so to speak, to see how people react? Is that typical?
Well, they all get their ideas different ways. A fair number of them got the idea from work they were already doing. And that's almost always the best way to get started, unless you don't like the work you're already doing, because you have an insight into where the gaps are. Two entrepreneurs I wrote about, their best friends, Jason Martin and Patrick Falvey, and they're ultra marathoners, they're best buddies. They worked at a software startup, and they noticed that there was a shortage of the type of applications that they needed for Salesforce specifically. Salesforce is a customer relationship management software. I don't know if it's a global one or just in the US. And that was how they got started developing apps for that program specifically. And they posted their business on Upwork. That was how they got their first customers. And then they graduated to other types of apps. And now they're an agency that makes apps. And they've got, similar to Jason, they have developers all over the world. And that was how they got their idea. Other people just make something that they themselves would want. Chris Mead is an entrepreneur who's in the opening chapter. And he and his brother and one of their good friends created CrossNet, which is this four-way volleyball game, kind of like Foursquare. So the court is like quadrants. And what they did was they went to Walmart, got two volleyball nets, and set them up that way. And then they just said, this would be awesome to play this game. And they kind of made it up as they went along. And they created a prototype. And then they went to, sorry, my battery is low. They went to Scheels, which is a sporting goods chain in the Midwest, and two stores agreed to carry it. And that was sort of their proof of concept. They sold out. So then Scheels said they wanted more of them for all of their stores. And then once you get that first customer and you can say this thing is selling out, or you or like Anna, right? Everybody's ordering the bikinis. That really helps the business to grow, because then other people would like to get in on it too. And that brings about investors. It brings about stores that will carry your product. Or if you have a service business, a lot of word of mouth. The more traction there is, I guess, the better off you are. Another way is research. And I think I shared this with you before we started. In the appendix of the book, what I did was I obtained data from the U.S. Census Bureau on the average revenue, the average payroll, and the average employee size for every industry in America. And I'm sure the industries are somewhat similar across countries, like aviation. You probably have that in every country, for instance. And then working with my daughters, who are really good in math, we programmed this Excel spreadsheet to figure out, if you subtracted the average payroll from the average revenue, which ones had the most money left over, because payroll is usually the biggest cost in any business that has employees. Sometimes it's real estate. It's a very, very rough proxy for profit, knowing that each industry has its own costs. Like if you need a brick and mortar store, that's a cost. So the payroll isn't the only one that you have to subtract to find out where the profit is. And I mentioned a reference at the New York University School of Business where they track the average profits for each industry. So I recommend, if you find one that's really interesting, that you then look at how profitable is this industry usually before you make any decisions, and talk to your trade association and other resources that can inform you before you start. And two things. One, it was very quirky which ones came out on top. To give you an idea, and I was completely shocked by all of these, for the up to four employees, the top one was casinos.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Casinos. Yeah, how do you have a four-person casino? But my poking around, I concluded these are probably little casinos they have in gas stations. The second one was creamery butter. So butter, like literally butter creameries, turns out they're very automated. So they have almost no payroll costs. The third one, there's a lot of manufacturing, these little factories, I guess, ethyl alcohol manufacturing. And
right.
Then the fourth one for people who are doctors was general medical and surgical hospitals. Sometimes a doctor, like if you had to have a test done, the doctor has their own little surgical center. It's these. I'm not recommending these specifically because, as you could see, they're so niche that.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, maybe not everybody would be up for doing a casino, right?
No.
People have different feelings about gambling. But I drew on the interviews I did to make some conclusions about which would be the best industries for the average smart person. And e-commerce came out on top. Mm-hmm. They're, especially business-to-business e-commerce, that is very hot. One example, Apurva Batra, who's a he was an engineer at Chevron. He's a young guy, about 29. He wanted a business that would allow him to travel the world. So what he sells are the plastic bags inside of cereal boxes. You see these bags all the
really?
Time. Is there a dad? Yeah. And inside of like a pharma product, like if, maybe if you go to the drugstore, there is a plastic bag around the product.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You just throw it away. You think nothing of it. Well, somebody makes them and someone sells them. He tried to go to trade shows and win accounts. And what he learned from that on-the-ground research is the really big companies like Kellogg, Cereal, they have their suppliers. They need such vast quantities. It would be hard for a small business to supply them. So he focused on the small and mid-sized, these little artisanal granola companies and mm-hmm. places like that who do need it. But what was different was he put it all online. So he can travel all over the place, and it's all automated. So once he set it all up, it became this beautiful little business. I think it's $3 million in revenue, and he started adding his first employees. Another category, I call it the souped-up service business, trade fine for dollars plus. And one example is Jenna Kutcher, who she is a photographer, and she started branching out from that by launching online photography classes. But where she really makes her money is she posts the photographs on Instagram, and mostly they're of her family, which has adorable young children. And she writes a little vignette with each picture, and she's built a huge following, and she gets a lot of advertising revenue from that. And she's able to be home with her kids. And she's not just trading time for dollars. She rarely does a photo shoot anymore. It's more amplifying her message through these other media. There's manufacturing. One fellow I interviewed, Jeffrey Stern, is an entrepreneur in his 60s. He makes the voice boxes for these little bears. We have a birthday party place in the U.S. called Build-A-Bear Workshop.
Yeah, we have those as well here. Yeah.
Oh, you have them too?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So that's the guy who makes them. And then
it's incredible.
It's like a great business. And also those birthday cards that you open and a song plays. He does that. And then wholesale is another one, like the ethyl alcohol. They sell to B2B clients. Some of these little factories are small. Financial services and technology. One entrepreneur, Greg Pesci, worked in the banking sector. And he hired these app developers to create the app for message pay. If you've ever gotten a bill in your text messages and they say, click on this link to pay your bill, mm-hmm. it's a company like his that created it. Now, that's one where not everybody has worked in financial services, but if you did, there are quite a number of people that have. That would be a good avenue. Transportation. Janine Iannarelli lives in Texas, and she sells used commercial jets. So sales, like in a lot of these industries, maybe you wouldn't manufacture an airplane as a tiny business, and you wouldn't drive a bus and get to seven-figure revenue, but something like that, a commission-based sales position. Another guy who went that route in one of the categories, construction, which is booming here in the U.S. I don't know if it is there. A lot of people here moved out of the big cities into the suburbs because of COVID.
Yeah, it's picking up here. It's picking up, definitely, yeah.
And this fellow, Wade Heiner, was a sales guy in and around the real estate space, and he had two buddies who were building homes, but they didn't have the sales skills, so they recruited him as an equity partner, and that, you know, that's how he got in on it. And it, and what they have is a unique niche. They make smaller family homes for less than $300,000. I'm terrible at converting numbers in my head. That's why I had my daughter do those charts. But it's a modestly priced home.
It's about 250.
And it really took off with all the young families. So you have to have something special about it, but they came up with that. So those are the categories, and there's a lot more about that in the book, but that's a starting place for people who feel like, oh, I'm not the next Elon Musk. I didn't come up with a great invention. A lot of these people are doing something pretty normal that where they're not really doing something brand new in the industry, but they found a way to do it at a scale where it's very profitable and that they can do it without a giant payroll. And that's, you know, where you get started. And then you have to really talk to the people in that industry and make sure you know what you're getting into before you spend all your savings on getting started. But, you know, there's lots of other books too that you can look at that are much more industry specific. This is a general book about the overall trend, but mm-hmm. there are like a zillion books on e-commerce that you could look at as well.
I think it's good to have books on trends, because I think the people I speak to who want to start a business or want to start in freelancing, whatever it may be, I think the biggest hurdle that they have to come across, or they come across, is actually knowing where to start or where the idea lies, and then what to do with that idea. How to how to sort of validate the idea, and then take it forward. So I think a book like this sounds like it would be good for somebody who needs that bit of inspiration, needs that bit of the inspiration to trigger the idea and validate the idea. And one thing that you mentioned, which you've kind of repeated as well, is that a lot of the people that have started these businesses have really sort of created niche businesses, as we say in the UK, or niche, as you say in the USA. So they say the riches are in the niches, don't they? So these businesses are very much focused around specific things, specific problems, or specific, like selling secondhand, you know, airplanes. Who would have even thought,
I mean, she was in the aviation industry before, but doing different things. So she picked up on this because she was there. And I think that's the big lesson for everybody, is like, you have a unique, even if you hate your job, there are things that you're learning from it that can be applied. Chris Mead with the volleyball game, he was selling, he was a cold caller for one of the food delivery apps. Mm-hmm. And he didn't really like that. Then when he had his own business, he was a really good cold caller of retail stores that might carry the volleyball game. So you may be developing things on someone else's dime, as Tim Ferriss would say, that then can be repurposed and used as a skill in your own business, or knowledge to help you find that little, I'll say niche, right? And, to dominate, because it's hard to dominate something like gloves or something that big if you're a three-person business, but maybe you can be the king of selling plastic bags to small and mid-sized businesses. Right, yeah. Not just plastic bags, but the plastic bags inside of cereal boxes. That's how
it's incredible. How
you want to drill down. It's really inspiring to me to see how these folks have really done this. And there are a lot of millionaire next door type businesses too. They're really not that sexy. They're not businesses that if you tell everybody at a cocktail party, they're going to be grilling you about every detail of the business. But what's so beautiful is it doesn't matter. You can have a really exciting entrepreneurial life figuring out the strategy for growing it and finding new profits and finding new customers, all the same things as a business that might be a little more glamorous, and build a really wonderful lifestyle for yourself and a lot of financial security. And it doesn't necessarily matter what industry, as long as it's the right one at the right time and the right one for you.
And I think you, again, something that you that chimes with me is that these people sound like they've really, okay, they've thought about what they're doing, they've learned from their own situations, and they've also taken on board things that they know, that they're in touch with their own skills and what they're good at, and then translated that into what they're doing. You've got a big chapter on become a learning machine. I really need to get into this book because it sounds like something that will really sort of excite me as well. So, no, it sounds really good, Elaine. So you're
Oh,
publishing,
thank you so much.
you're going to, it's going live on the, you said the 14th of February?
The 15th of
15th of
February, one
February.
day after Valentine's Day. It's available for pre-order now. And I hope that anyone who listens to the program will have an opportunity to write to me if they have any questions. I really love hearing from people, and it makes me a better journalist. I'm available for messaging back and forth on Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter. So I hope folks do reach out.
Yeah, and what I'll do is I'll leave your I'll leave your is do you prefer to be get in touch with by LinkedIn or how what's the best place to get in touch with you?
LinkedIn would be great.
LinkedIn.
That's the one I'm most active on. And yeah, I wish everybody luck with their businesses. And you and I have to reconnect at some point because
We
I do
will.
want to interview you about what you've been up to.
No, we will. And I think there's so many more questions I want to ask you on this. Elaine, so we will reconnect. But everybody who's listening, I would urge you to look out for Elaine Pohlfeld's book. I'm sure you'll be on Amazon and all those other channels, right? Yep.
Yes.
It's called The Tiny Business, Big Money: Strategies for Creating a High Revenue Micro Business. So, Elaine, I just want to say thank you so much. Lovely to see you again, and you're always welcome on the show. And we'll be chatting soon, I'm sure.
Oh, thank you. Yes, definitely. We have a lot to talk about. Thank you so much for having me on.
Definitely. Anytime, Elaine.